Thank you very much, and it's a pleasure to be with you. I'm delighted to have this opportunity to join with my friends. I had a long association with the Witte Institute, with the with Moscow State University, and with the Free Economic Society. So this is an opportunity for me to say a warm hello to friends and colleagues. I also would like to mention that this is the 12th anniversary of the passing of a close friend who really introduced me to the community of economists in Russia, Alexei Shevyakov. Those of you who may remember him, this is just a moment to reflect on his contributions as well. This is I would like to speak in the spirit right close to that of my of our colleague from Kazakhstan, who is attempting, I think, to provide an assessment of the ways in which we think about economic problems. And I would like to do something quite similar, but from a different, let's just say a different perspective or a different way of approaching these questions. This is a project which emerges in part from a number of papers that I have been working on in recent months and over the past few years, dealing with a range of policy questions, all of which share the general implication that there is something badly wrong with the way in which economic theory underlies the way most economists are accustomed to thinking about policy questions. The papers I've written deal with inflation, they've dealt with sanctions, they've dealt with the emerging multipolarity of the currency world. And in each of these cases, there's an underlying, let's say, critique of the mainstream perspective. And this goes back to something very basic, which is foundational to most economics, which is the theory of value. Foundation is not often, let's say, disturbed in the course of work. A theory of value has been has underpinned most teaching in economics in a very subtle fashion for nearly a century now. In our view, this is joint work with a mathematician, Jing Chen, who's originally from China and now based at the University of Northern British Columbia, we believe that it is time to reconsider the theory of value and to do so in a way which creates a unity between political economy, economics in general, physics, and biology. And to do that, we present a very simple and straightforward alternative perspective. It's a non-equilibrium theory. It's essentially as simple as a logarithmic equation, and it takes into account two factors that are, I think, fundamental to the determination of value economics. One of them is scarcity, and the other one is market power, the issue of monopoly and oligopoly. It is a theory which is rooted in physical realities in economic institutions, and it is therefore objective in a sense similar to that of the information theory, which was developed by Shannon in 1948. So this is quite a contrast to the subjective theory which has been expressed in its highest form by Arrow and De Bruy, and is the foundation of general equilibrium economics, the concept of equilibrium being, I think, the fundamental deficiency in the mainstream view of how economics should be considered and thought. Well, if we go back quickly over theories of value in general, we'll find that ours is, in fact, has a close kinship to those of classical political economy. Ricardo and Marx articulated, as everyone here would know, a labor theory of value. The difference is that a theory of value which is rooted in entropy is broader than a labor theory of value, since there are resources which have low entropy in addition to labor, which do not necessarily require labor, but they definitely have economic value. Scarcity is a scarcity theory. It is therefore also in the tradition of Walras, who proposed a scarcity theory, but did not succeed in having it adopted, because at the same time, Jevons and later Marshall and finally Arrow and de Bruijn basically took over the field with a subjective theory of value rooted in the metaphor of the lever, based on the concept of equilibrium, and essentially psychological in character, that is to say, based upon the tastes and preferences of consumers and producers. And this has been the basis of mainstream economics since at least the 1950s. Now, I think, as I'm sure you know, Nicholas Georgescu-Regan and others have tried to interject the idea that there should be an entropy basis for value, but it was not fully developed in Georgescu-Rogan's work, and partly because of the transformation problems seemed to be too difficult for him. But in our view, this is a natural basis for value. It is a basis that is rooted in physics. It is a scarcity theory. Entropy is a measure of scarcity. It is a thesis which places an emphasis on the need to obtain resources for survival. Resources have low probability, they're scarce. That entropy is the measure of probability of a system. And entropy, according to the law of thermodynamics, systems move from low to high entropy states. The second law of thermodynamics is often misunderstood as an image of waste and death. But the fact is, from a non-equilibrium perspective, which is what we suggest here, the entropy flow, which is manifested in many different ways, heat, light, electricity, water, many other forms, is the fountain of life. All living organisms tap into the entropy flow from the environment for survival, so it's a natural measure of value for living systems, including human beings. It takes effort to maintain a state of low entropy. Now, the state of low entropy is the universal sign of attractiveness for animals, which include human beings. This explains the relationship between physical entropy, physics of entropy, and the psychology of utility. Utilities are generally related to entropy, so that entropy theory underpins a utility theory of value, but it's not the same thing. All human activities consume low entropy resources, and entropy theory of value also includes the labor theory, but it's broader. Other low entropy sources, such as oil or uranium, will have value as well. And all living creatures who have access to low entropy seek to defend it. So for this reason, monopoly power, the control over resources, is an integral part of an entropy theory. So what is how can one express this in mathematical form? The basis of our theory is extremely simple. One is that the physical scarcity of good or surplus, which is given its probability in relation to the scale of a market. You can think of this in terms of market penetration. The other is the number of entities providing this service. And the insight, which I have to credit to my colleague Jing Chen, is that one can characterize the number of providers with the base of the logarithm function. It's very similar to information theory, in which the base of the logarithm is chosen to be 2 due to the fact that information is transmitted in bytes. But this provides a simple and elegant way to build the idea of market power into a value theory, an idea which has been neglected in the standard utility theory, which tries to represent the perfect market as having no market power. But in fact, all a living system seek to obtain a certain amount of control over resources. So it's a fundamental part of the way in which we should think about this problem. The mathematics, therefore, is as simple as what I'm just showing you, that in general, if the scarcity of a product is represented by a probability measure, then the piece of I across, say, scarcity across different markets, the expected value of the product is the average of the value of each possibility, which is given by the second equation on this slide. And this is essentially identical to the measures of information in Shannon's information theory to the measures of entropy. So we're simply taking into economics a form which is extremely familiar to everybody who works in physical or computer science. You can then show how scarcities are related to value. As a product becomes less scarce and the probability increases, its value is going to decline. And this is represented, essentially can be calculated off of the equation I just gave you. Similarly, the monopoly, the value of a product is related to the number of providers. As the base of the logarithm function increases, the value of the product declines. The more entities providing the product in the market, the less value it will have. One cannot, and very rarely does one see a pure monopoly where the base would be one. That's why we start at 1.1. But such a monopoly, if it ever exists, it would have to be highly regulated, or it would become essentially unbearable. In any event, those two relationships give you just about everything that we have to offer, and you can see that the probability increases, as the market penetration increases, the total value of a commodity is going to first rise as the number that have been produced and consumed increases, but it ultimately reaches a peak and then declines. And at a complete penetration, complete absence of scarcity, the value will return to a very low level, in fact, to zero. As I've said before, this is an objective theory, even though many elements that go into the determination of value are not known. Value of petroleum is estimated because the geology is not certain, what alternatives are there is not certain, the market size is not certain. But nevertheless, there is an underlying objective reality. So this is not a subjective or utility-based theory. It's similar to information theory, in which a lower bound to the file size specifies the information content of a message. So essentially a similar thing. We can use it in many different contexts. It helps illuminate the use of regulation. Strong firms use regulation to increase the entry barriers, the fixed costs, and raise their own rate of return by reducing competition. The segmentation of markets is a means of increasing valuation in the market for every provider. Trade. One can use this very precisely, actually, to calculate the winners and losers in resource-rich and resource-poor societies as free trade policies are adopted. One can use it to conceptualize the effects of tariffs, the effects of sanctions, such as currently operating in both on Europe and on the Russian Federation, the effect of a reserve currency monopoly or the erosion of that monopoly through the creation of a multipolar system. All of this is really, really fits into the ambit of the expressions I've just given you. It also has, I think, a significant role in thinking, helping us think about the comparison between countries in terms of the traditional measures of gross domestic product, which if you think about, for example, the case of the United States, which is an economy heavily based upon service labor, which is given a valuation essentially by regulatory mechanisms, not based on the underlying scarcity of human labor, you can see that that is going to give you quite a distorted image of the underlying, let's say, entropy basis of the strength of the economy. So this is, again, some of the many applications and implications of this approach, which we develop in the article that will be published in the review of evolutionary political economy. In contrast, of course, we're going up against a very solidly entrenched and longstanding basis of economic thought, which gives a high priority to the role of markets and to creation and establishment and maintenance of it, or the tendency toward a general equilibrium. That position is going to be and has been stoutly defended by the mainstream of the economics profession, because it's the basis of their own, if you like, monopoly position in academic life and in thinking about policy implications. This is natural, and it is. We expect that there will be considerable resistance to rethinking these questions. But I am hopeful that for those who are trained in the underlying physics and biology, who are trained in information theory, who can think about these questions from a multidisciplinary and scientific perspective, that it may be possible to unify economics with modern science in a rewarding way. So while it's dangerous to present a new theory, I do so here with some hope, and I appreciate your attention. Thank you very much. Спасибо большое.